I was shocked, simply shocked, by your presentation, Father Thomas Joseph White. Because it seems to me that you're basically arguing that the human person desires happiness by virtue of our nature. It's our nature to desire happiness. That happiness is impossible without friendship with God. Mm-hmm. Friendship with God is not possible without grace. Therefore, grace is owed to the human creature. For without grace, our nature is frustrated. So it seems as though you've maneuvered yourself into a position that most Thomists would reject. How do you respond?
Yeah. So the last time we had this kind of format, we allowed the speakers to come up to the podium. So we'll just continue that here, which requires us to displace ourselves a bit, but I hope it's okay. That's a great objection, and it's a left hook. I didn't see it coming, because what he's trying to do is he's claiming that I'm obliging myself to follow the thesis of Henri de Lubac, articulated in the mid-20th century in the famous book Surnaturel, that the human being is made uniquely for a supernatural end, and so the human being has... This is de Lubac's famous argument. He's a great Jesuit theologian. It's a very controversial book, that according to which... In his reading of Aquinas, the human being can only ever find its own true purpose and meaning in life through the supernatural, and so that without the supernatural, human life becomes unintelligible. And it's strangely a kind of Christian postmodernism, so that, you know, grace makes sense of the puzzle of what it is to be a human being, but without grace, the human being remains a kind of unintelligible enigma. And so what he's doing is he's pressing on me to say how if human nature doesn't have certain forms of happiness that it can attain to in a stable way without grace, then, and it can only be happy with grace, then aren't I really saying the same thing as de Lubac, which he knows I disagree with. I'm in print a little bit on this point too, so he's trying to also publicly humiliate me. That's a good thing to do to a Catholic religious. And anyway. I set out to defend a pure position, which is that of Augustine's, which I feel is a little unnuanced, but it's very powerful. So I was trying to articulate a position I think is in some ways very attractive, the either or, stark black or white portrait of happiness that you get in Pascal and in Augustine, and there are elements of this kind of thinking in Aquinas. Now Aquinas does, as he's always a kind of a gentleman when he disagrees with Augustine. He does it in a very nuanced way. So unless you had kind of the equivalent in the conceptual world of British manners, you wouldn't realize that he was disagreeing with you. The move he makes here, Aquinas is to say, well, of course, in some way, everyone must experience some degree of happiness in life. And there must be all kinds of ways and forms that happiness can take shape in us. However, they are typically in some way imperfect. And so instead of just saying that kind of the kind of unmasking move that Augustine makes, where like, let's unmask all the ways that you tell yourself you're happy, but in fact you're not really examining the depth structures of your own desires, and so you don't know yourself really well, Aquinas puts it in a more positive, kind of gentle way and saying, well, it's true we do take a certain happiness in sensual pleasures. We do take a certain happiness in honors. We do take a certain legitimate happiness in knowledge and in virtue and development of character. And yet, then he kind of undermines the idea that you could put your final resting place in those things. So it's the move that Professor Vogler was denoting with the notion of more, of wanting more. It's a more positive way of putting it. And so I would want to talk probably in a more complete account about imperfect happiness as being something very real, to talk about the fact that in order to indicate that our human nature acting on its own and without reference perhaps to the world of grace or religious aspirations can achieve certain non-trivial forms of imperfect happiness. But it's a little bit, ironic and maybe banalizing to go down that road without sort of also hitting the other side of the of the emphasis that it's really imperfect, and that we really are moved by deep wellsprings of desire and thirst for meaning and happiness that aren't really placated by a lot of the human banalities that we rest in or repose in ways that are all too superficial. So I think you could maybe put the emphasis, recalibrate a little bit by going back toward the notion of imperfect happiness and still defend the Augustinian idea without ceding this idea. I agree with you. We don't want to say human nature just makes no sense or has no purpose on its own without grace.
Professor Jennifer Frey, I want to challenge you on your notion that a secular person can be happy. I'm wondering, you describe your, are your colleagues, because I share your intuition, which is that people we call secular people, many of them attain a perhaps imperfect but nevertheless real happiness. But I'm wondering, are they really non-religious in the sense that you describe it? So you say that religion is rendering that which is due to God. But what if we shift the definition that religion is rendering that which is due to the highest good? Or maybe we'll make it a little bit more modern and phenomenological and say, the virtue of religion is rendering that which is due to what one believes to be the highest good. And so that really your colleagues are not really materialist in any sense, because they do actually, the ones that are happy are actually serving, rendering that which is due to what they conceive to be the highest good, whether it's family or truth or some other thing is greater than the self.
Yeah, okay, thanks. That's helpful. I think you've slightly changed what religion is, though. And that's cool. That's cool, but then on your notion of religion, non-religious people can be religious, and I just wasn't contemplating that. But I suppose I need to push back though against the conflation between secularism and materialism, because I hang out with some pretty sophisticated secularists, and they're not materialists, at least not in any flat-footed sense. And they're not, they're not reductive materialists. It's not so much a question of whether you're a materialist. It's really a question of just whether you believe in the supernatural. And they don't. They don't have that category. And they aren't being dumb and not having that category. These are smart people who have thought about it. And in many cases, they are people who are open to the possibility, and they just don't see it, right? They just don't see it. Some of them, I think very sincerely, would like there to be a God. And I have talked to them about that. That they're sort of envious that people believe in God, because it makes everything tidy. I mean, I'm always like, no, it doesn't. It does not help at all. But it's the question of God and whether there is one. And for these people, they have reasons to doubt. But as you rightfully point out, of course, they are pursuing real goods. And they do have religion in the, I suppose, formal sense that they refer what they do to what they take to be the highest good. And for many of these people, you know, they're very committed to their communities. They're committed to social justice. They've made huge sacrifices. They're good people. They're good people. But they don't go to church because that doesn't make sense to them. So if we want to say that they're non-religiously religious, that's okay. I'm okay with that, so long as we separate that from materialism.
Candace Vogler. Candace, I want to challenge the sort of the final bit of your presentation, where you talk about, you warn that Christianity won't make you happy, at least not in our usual sense of happiness, or it might not, or we're warned by the scriptures that it's very likely not to. But I'm wondering whether you've really assessed this in the right way. In other words, there's no question but that the Christian life involves trials. But I'm wondering whether you're conflating trials, which can be very difficult to endure, with unhappiness or a lack of happiness. And I'm gonna put it this way, by analogy to the marathon runner. Okay, so I'm training for a marathon, and that's what I must deny myself. Perhaps I have to have a special diet, or I have to spend all this time running, and the running itself can be quite painful. I actually did train for a marathon when I was younger, and I would not describe my suffering as a source of unhappiness. So I would freely acknowledge that it constituted a kind of suffering, but it was paradoxically perfectly consistent with a great deal of happiness as I embarked on sacrificing for a higher end. So, and if faith is a supernatural virtue, then all the more that it would be able to be consistent, the happiness of faith would be consistent with very real suffering.
Thank you. I mean, what I actually said was that I thought you would be mad to decide you were going to convert to Christianity for the sake of temporal happiness, which, I mean, might work if somehow your boss was more likely to give you a raise or something like that. And the material in Scripture I was referring to was the many, many, many times that, you know, that Jesus figure was telling you that you might be murdered for this, you would be reviled for this, that people would hate you because of his name. I mean, that sort of thing. And, you know, of course, it could get you killed in the early church in a really nasty way. I mean, there's a whole lot of martyrdom that happened. And I'm sort of perfectly willing to suppose that people were willing to endure tremendous suffering and hardship for the sake of the faith, and have been for a very, very long time. I think that to call that temporal happiness would be stoic in a way I find objectionable.
That's a kind of an equivocation on temporal.
No, temporal means in this mortal life.
Well, but my point is that when I was actually running and suffering while I was running, in that moment, I was happy.
I mean, I take it that what you're trying to do in Christianity, at least as I understand it and the varieties of it that I've known, is cultivate exactly the kind of friendship and faithful relation with God that Father Thomas Joseph was discussing, and open yourself to grace, and that you do that with some confidence that, I don't know, if you read discussions of martyr courage or something, that there's a kind of infused help that you're likely to get if what you're doing is undergoing suffering because of your faith. I mean, that's a frequent form of grace that is amply testified to and recorded in all kinds of ways. And that it's genuine suffering, and that Aristotle was not like one of those Stoics who thought that I could be friendless in pain, dying alone in a horrible way for the entertainment of other people or something. And if I had virtue, then I would be happy. I mean, it's like you can have that kind of a view. Now, the thing that you were describing is more like aiming at a higher thing for yourself, possibly, in training for a marathon. That can be a thing that has a place in people's sense of themselves and their lives. And being willing to suffer for that, and that's true of almost any major thing that people work toward. I mean, the idea that if it's worth having, it's worth suffering a little on the way toward getting it, that's, I think, really strong common sense, and is true of most human goods. I was just thinking that if you were thinking that you were going to undertake a serious commitment to something like some particular variation of Christianity, that you are undertaking a serious commitment to something that requires that you have a very lively sense of your own sinfulness, which is like not pleasant, a lively sense of your own imperfection, an incredible desire to being open to faith and being open to growth in all these ways that are potentially painful and might cost you some worldly thing that looks pretty good, actually. That was the kind of thing I was thinking. And so in that sense, I was relating it to the imaginary Sufi dancer who was somehow thinking he was in it for the money or something. And it's like, no, you're not. You're in it for something else. And that's what that form of worship is about, a different kind of thing. That was all I was meaning to say. But of course, there's the good of Christian community, there's the good of fellowship, there's the good of cultivating friendship with God. How great is that? Pretty great.
All right, let's, if we have questions, challenges, denunciations from the floor. Yes.
Direct your attention to the one thing I'm sure I understood, and that's the cartoon. I've got two questions about that. The first is for Professor Frey. This one image here, don't let it set in, the shaking visage and okay. Sweating yeah. Person. Right? So the seemingly the reasonable and seemingly happy person, secular person, that you you're thinking of, and your colleagues and people in the world, do they experience this? And if they do, does that invalidate the saying that they are in fact happy?
So I don't. Sorry, can I?
We don't have the handout.
Oh, okay. The existential dread. Yeah. I honestly, I'm not sure that existential dread is solely the province of the secular, but sorry, are you asking if they experience existential
yeah.
dread? I mean, I couldn't say a priori, or I wouldn't want to say a priori either way, but I mean, maybe.
Well, if so, can we say
especially
that?
If they're, you know, a certain age in which we all start to experience it, you know, but they probably get over it, right? I mean, people who, so they don't let it set in, I guess, or maybe they have these moments of existential crisis, you know, but the difference between, you know, the successful happy person and the, you know, the guy in the back wearing all black is that they moved on, right? And I think it's related to a kind of mature acceptance of finitude. I think for a lot of them, they understand, whereas they have this sense of things that things are kind of radically contingent. It's just a radically contingent fact that I exist at all, that I have anything, that I was born in a wealthy industrial society, that I have these opportunities. There's often maybe a sense of gratitude. But they don't, I mean, they just don't look for some larger cosmic unity to everything. And they just have a kind of mature acceptance of the fact that, well, it's all very quick, isn't it? Then I'll just do the best that I can with...
Can I ask you to answer the question in relation to a situation where the person faced with the existential dread feels that because of something terrible that's happened to a child or a wife, and the utter inability to explain it, a sense of being torn apart by loss?
Right, more like despair.
Not simply the loss of his own sense of equilibrium, but confronting the radical tragedies that life can present to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody who's a secularist who confronts them is going to turn to the Lord, but you've got to. It's there that the rubber hits the road when your sense of what the world is all about, purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It's not materialism. It's something sort of in between, and day to day I can conjure up enough purposes
mm-hmm.
to rationalize everything that's happening to me. But suddenly, child is dead, wife has cancer, things close in terribly.
Mm-hmm.
And you start saying, what's it all about? Something between materialism and reductionism and non-reductionism. Are there resources in the individual, are those resources of the individual enough to carry through?
I think potentially yes. So my stepfather is a chaplain, and he's basically the guy that comes to talk to you when somebody's in your family has died in the hospital. But he also works for the Red Cross. And so when there's some major catastrophe, like 9/11, he was assigned to Cantor Fitzgerald families. That was the firm where almost everyone died. And he basically lived and worked with them here in New York for about a month. And many of those people were secular. You know, with help, there are resources for overcoming that kind of tragedy. And obviously not everyone does, but that's equally true for deeply religious people. There are deeply religious people who lose their faith when something like that happens. And it's almost automatic. I mean, the kind of anger and anguish. In a sense, it's almost easier for a secular person because they didn't expect anything from a god or and so I do think, just as a matter of fact, there are those resources, and there's just a different understanding of death and what it means.
As a follow-up question to her, to
yep.
Father. Father, as for the other pictures,
cartoon next to Jesus is very important.
That's the only thing I can clearly understand. Your argument was that since we are capable of God, which is the only appropriate intensity of pleasure, the highest good, and the only really truly stable from disenchantment. That's why we can't be fully satisfied by anything sub-God, anything less than God. But aren't you underestimating the power of modern life to construct a fortress against disenchantment and amplify to an extreme degree, like never before in human history, the experience of sub-God pleasures, so that really we don't ever notice that there is something wrong? And if we're behind that fortress and amped up by these aides, how do you preach? How do you preach to them? Do you take an approach like Professor Frey, which says, yes, you are experiencing something that's genuine, non-trivial, stable, happy, Or do you take the sledgehammer and try and unmask?
Always the sledgehammer, right?
Well, it's an interesting question about, like, he's turned to a more, we call it, you know, practical theological question or pastoral theological question. But I would say, you know, I would be careful about overly accentuating the grave difficulties of our own era, because when you look, I'm not really a historian by trade, but I've done enough historical reading to know that the capacity of the human being to distract itself from rigorous questions of meaning is not a uniquely modern phenomenon. And actually, we have a tremendous wealth of resources. I mean, just the level of education, people might actually be taught to read Boethius's On the Consolation of Philosophy, where they might not even know it existed, you know, before. So there's all kinds of ways that we're engaged in questioning that we might not be otherwise. I would even say that's true of the internet, that the internet allows you to see, you know, maybe 90% garbage, but there's actually a lot of good truth-seeking stuff that you can find in all kinds of forms. So that being said, you're posing the question of like a spiritual anesthetization, a kind of anesthesia box. We put the soul in, and distraction. This is Pascal's great theme in the Pensées, about whether we can distract ourselves to such a deep extent that we can kind of anesthetize the soul's restless desires for something that transcends the goods of this world, or become then by configuration to convention, scared or perplexed by the idea that we would reach out beyond the physical world to things that break with convention. And so then it's a kind of a vicious circle. The more you have an irreligious or non-religious secularized society, the more it seems like a scary, weird thing to even ask the question. And we can see that some people in the Muslim community, for example, just find that all a terrible facade and think it's a big lie and needs to be opposed. And I think there is, you know, some intelligibility, even if one wants to really, you know, question the means that are sometimes taken by some people in questioning, like, the validity of the secular framework. The second part of the question was...
How do you preach?
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to be a uselessly Dominican and say that's a prudential question. That, in other words, it depends on your audience. And there are people who you might want to kind of really confront with... Just take the analogy of your extended family. And think about if you were a religious person trying to talk to your extended family about the good of religion and your family was largely secularized, or there was a whole range and degree out there. I mean, you might talk to this person in the family different than that person, depending on a whole range of things. And it's the same with subcultures, because if we had this event in Southeast Georgia, we would have a different, you know, set of interlocutors than if we had it in Manhattan. And so, you know, you get subcultures and you get, you know, challenges that you have to develop a kind of pastoral intelligence of where to find the sufficient intellectual sympathy for Christian positions to engage people in ways that take their concerns seriously, but also interpolate them and challenge them.
Yes.
So this is...
Good. Belt it out.
This is a question for Father Thomas Joseph. Is there a distinction in your eyes between joy and happiness, and does religion, the virtue of religion, help to make that distinction?
Yeah, actually, these two people probably know more about what Aquinas says on joy than I do, but joy is not something that we possess with the same potential stability as happiness, because happiness for Aquinas comes about as the fruit or the fruition of stable dispositions of virtue. So like I can be, say I'm an artist and I'm happy when I'm painting beautiful, you know, canvases, and I have a stable capacity to do that, well then I have a stable disposition, I can attain a kind of artistic happiness regularly. Joy is like more of a spiked thing that happens, and Aquinas does first treat it as a passion of the soul, that's say an emotion, And that can be, that's physiological. So you can have animal joy. Like, you know, when you come home and the little dog comes running up and it's like happy because it knows that it's going to get taken for a walk, it's going to get to eat, you know, like that little animal's in us, except I agree with Candace, it's in us a very spiritual little animal. But if you put chocolate out, if you put the Lindt chocolate out at the party, like there's sensate joy, expectation of sensate joy, and people are going around, they want the joy of the chocolate fix. And then that, but that's like the lesser analogy, and then you've got the higher kind of radiant spiritual joy. So like the joy of discovering in friendship that the person that you really care about or like feels similarly to yourself, and that you might have a stable possession of friendship, or, you know, the joy of being in love with someone and feeling like they're in love with you, which a lot of people talk to priests about, and this is a very important thing to us, of course. And then there's like, but okay, in the spiritual level, the mystical level, like, can something like falling in love with someone or being friends with someone or having the capacity to do something stably like paint pictures exist with God? And I think for Aquinas, the answer is not by nature, but by grace. That's to say, I can't just go out there and want to become like this very religious person and then I will acquire joy with God through my own stable possession, but that there is a gift character to intimacy with God where God sort of elevates the soul by moment. These are called, in Aquinas' language, gifts of the Holy Spirit, where the Holy Spirit gives you sort of spiked experiences of the presence of God in the soul. If you want to read about this, you can read about it in someone like Saint Elizabeth, Blessed Elizabeth of the Trinity, or Teresa of Avila. If you want to see a phenomenological version, you can see what these Carmelite saints are talking about from the inside. And that seems to be a very real phenomenon. And then, but I think that the living under grace, the stability of the virtue of religion, that's to say becoming a prayerful person by like a very active discipline in monastic community or in one's own life as a layperson through a very engaged regime of prayer, is the best disposition to receiving the gifts of the Holy Spirit. So that if there's not it's not an accidental relationship between the fact that many people who have cultivate a more intensive prayer life have more mystical experiences. And if you go to a contemplative monastery and you ask the nuns why they entered or why they've stayed, you know, they have regular experiences of God that are part of the motivation for why they entered in the first place and what sustains them. So I would say mystical experience is very real, but that joy of that is not itself the sufficient condition to sustain a moral Christian life. Right, because charity is not always felt. This is John of the Cross's great point. You don't always feel charity. It moves under the surface often. Mother Teresa went through this very interesting, long experience, which is not a non-mystical experience, but she had what John of the Cross calls the dark night of the soul, long, prolonged experience of deprivation and union. And her charity for the poorest people in the world grew more intensive during that time, as did her love for God. So sometimes not having consolations is just as in also in long-term relationships, sometimes we grow most morally when we don't have consolations. And so joy is important, but it's not everything.
Yes.
This question is for Dr. Frank. Question about the virtue of religion. So you very helpfully defined it for us.
Uh-huh.
And so it's kind of a two-part question.
Okay.
Go either way. So the first question is, do you think there is a virtue of religion, as Aquinas and as you defined it? And if you think there's a virtue of religion, then how can that play into the idea of imperfect happiness that you presented to us if you need all the virtues, at least in a proportionate way, to even have an imperfect kind of happiness? Maybe you disagree with that idea of unity of the virtues, but let's throw that out there.
I don't.
Okay, so then maybe you can explain how imperfect happiness would relate to the acquiring of the other virtues and things like that. So, and if you don't think that the virtue of religion is a real virtue, what would its source be, and is it a vice?
Oh, okay. Well, thankfully, I do think it's a real virtue, so I don't have to answer that last question. But, okay, so, yeah, I think it's a real virtue.
I'm not sure so much if you're asking about my view or Aquinas' view, but I mean, for Aquinas, he says it's the chief of all the moral virtues. One, I suppose, because it's related to justice, and justice is the form of the acquired virtues. But Aquinas thinks that through religion, we direct all of our good actions to God. And so in that sense, it ends up being the most important of the moral acquired virtues. And of course, now, I mean, this gets into like super contested territory. So I'll just admit that I think I read Aquinas as having a pretty robust notion of acquired virtue, a pagan virtue. And so I take him to be saying, I mean, he's pretty clear in the little treatise on religion that, you know, the pagans had true religion in his sense. Now, obviously, they weren't Christians. And so, obviously, their true religion isn't going to get them, you know, the real deal stuff in the end any more than their true justice was. But it's part of that. It's part of our natural end, right? And Aquinas does think that we have a nature and we have a natural end, and that the intelligibility of the acquired virtues comes from that, right? I mean, they help us attain that natural end, and then grace is supposed to perfect nature, but of course that presupposes nature. Presupposes something substantive to be perfected. And so, of course, charity and faith, Christian faith, are going to perfect the virtue of religion, right? But you can have it.
I don't deny that, but I guess it's kind of what Rusty Reno was saying. If you have secular people who really do have a kind of robust sense of imperfect happiness, shouldn't they have something like the virtue of religion in order to express that?
Where, like, they just meditate? Or, I mean,
And somehow in doing some kind of public act of worship. It could be meditation. I don't know. It depends.
But what are they worshiping, you know? Are they...
But I think, Jim, he's saying if the virtues are connected and you don't have religion, and religion's necessary for moral flourishing, how can you really argue... He's trying to say that, how can you say the secular person really has the virtues if the virtues are all connected and they don't have religion?
Oh, I see.
I was arguing that they have a kind of implicit religion in the sense that, you know, environmentalism can become a kind of religion.
Yeah.
You know, we mock that, but, I mean, I've mocked it, but I'm coming to realize that, well, maybe I should be more generous and realize that, well, hey, if you can't have explicitly have the virtue of religion, to have it implicitly, at least you have the opportunity of some imperfect fulfillment of your nature.
Yeah, I see now. I can, yeah, no, this is hard. I'm not sure. I feel torn here. Because I don't, I mean, I, yeah. I guess I was thinking that it's sufficient to have justice as the form of the acquired virtues that gives them the relevant unity. Now, Aquinas says that religion is a proper part, or maybe it's an improper part. It's a part, I mean, he relates it to justice, but it's not...
Potential part,
there you go. But it's not... that's a hard question. I'm not sure what to say. I mean, I guess my inclination, which I'm not going to be able to sufficiently defend, just to be honest, is to say, yeah, no, it's okay. If you've got justice, it's going to be enough. Because the only thing that's lacking is a belief in this higher being that is worthy of, that you owe something to, right? So there's supposed to be an idea of a creator of all things to which you owe acts of devotion and prayer and all of this other stuff. But if you don't believe in that, and they don't, right? And I see you're saying, well, this, you know, is going to render it all asunder, but I'm not sure, because really justice is the glue holding it all together. And if it turns out that there is a God, then of course something's really missing, right? But I'm not answering that question. I still think that justice can give you the unity of the virtues. Just be agnostic about God for right now.
But if, I mean, I so understand, because you don't want to abuse the plain sense of what religion is by making, you know, so environmentalism is a religion, and you sort of think, well, that's an abuse of the notion of religion. It's stretching too far. But if Aquinas is right in his analysis, then wouldn't we expect secular progressives to make God of politics? Because there's a natural tendency then to take their commitments of justice and to elevate them and have them take on religious-like qualities. And a certain zealotry that we associate with religion begins to appear in their political commitments and convictions.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's how fast and loose we want to play with words like worship, you know? I mean, sure, there's an analogous sense, but, I mean, they don't really think that they're worshiping. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're going to sneer at that. Mm-hmm. And it's true that, there are secular people who do end up worshiping nature, and they just can't admit it. But I mean, the short answer.
Religious people who end up worshiping religion. I mean, religious can be a vice for Aquinas in religious people. There's a lot of, they're not vitiated with regards to other things. They're vitiated in being religious. You can be viciously religious for Aquinas. And in fact, it's not just like non-Catholic, medieval Catholic Christians. He thinks medieval Catholic Christians can also suffer from specifically religious vices, like superstition or a kind of lack of gratitude or lack of self-application. So you can be religiously lax or religiously superstitious. You can be overly political as a religious person, or political in unrealistic ways, or unrealistically utopian. There's all kinds of religious vices too, but of course this is different than, say, you know, Freud or Nietzsche thinking religion is just really a vice of character, and it's really showing that you're something. There's something where you typically lack fortitude, and you kind of lack temperance, because you believe too much intemperately, and you've lacked the fortitude to be restrained in what you believe. I think they think religion's a vice in a much more, you know, univocal way. I think Aquinas thinks plenty of religious vitiation, mm-hmm. but there's also more fundamentally a virtue.
We'll do one more question. Yeah.
My question is directed to Professor Frey. As a Catholic, I believe that true, genuine happiness can only exist in the metaphysical realm, because this happiness about which we're speaking today is an experience of the human soul. And I would suspect that the secular person would probably disagree, because they believe that happiness exists not in any metaphysical realm, but exists squarely in the physical realm. So my question for you is this. In this physical realm, between our ears is a 3-pound blob of fats and proteins, a blob in which minerals and chemicals are in constant flux, sending electrical signals to the rest of our body. If this 3-pound blob is where happiness resides, then where along the evolutionary spectrum is happiness no longer attainable? Is it the cat, the dog, the New York City cockroach, the flower? And why is this happiness attainable for us, but not for an organism like, say, a flower?
Okay, this gets back to my problem with what Rusty was saying about materialism. So the kind of picture, I mean, your question depends on this kind of reductive materialism in which, you know, we're really our brains and, you know, our mental life is really just brain states and neurons firing and it's all locatable. I think that's bad philosophy. Not to attribute that to you, but just I don't accept that picture of the human person, and I don't accept that picture of the mind, and I don't think that happiness is located anywhere in particular, even though I acknowledge that there is a subjective component of happiness. I wouldn't want to pick out a neuron firing and say it's there. You see it. And as for the metaphysical realm, there are plenty of secular people who would accept something like a soul, suitably understood, and then, you know, and then that gets really complicated really quickly. But if you just think that the soul is a principle of life, living thing, which is what Aristotle thought, it doesn't have to be immortal. It doesn't have to be a supernatural thing. And in fact, you know, where I was raised philosophically, everybody was an atheist, but they seemed to have something like a theory of soul in the Aristotelian sense. So I don't think you have to be a reductive materialist if you're secular. I think that within secularism, there's a whole range of metaphysical accounts that you might adopt. So I certainly a secular person could think that they live in a metaphysical realm. And I think a lot of secular philosophers do think that. So I have a hard time answering the question as posed in terms of these kinds of dualisms, which I sort of think we should just reject, regardless of revelation or religious commitments, but just philosophically we should reject them.
All right, I would want to wrap up here. You know, it seems to me that that our thoughts on happiness actually kind of swing between two very different poles. I think on the one side, we think of happiness as a kind of fulfillment. So happiness is ecstatic. So we're reaching and we get to what we desire. I mean, that certainly came out in the Augustinian Pascalian themes that you brought forward. But it seems in the tradition there's also another pole, and I think John Cannon was alluding to it in his comment from the floor, and that's happiness as invulnerability rather than as fulfillment. Happiness is being stable and, being able to have some touchstone or some foundation on which to endure the flux of life and the vicissitudes of life. Or happiness is related to consolation. You mentioned, Father, consolation of philosophy, which is not a ecstatic but rather much more of this theme of invulnerability rather than ecstatic fulfillment. I think that we in our own lives and in our own era work across that swing. I mean, part of the genius, it seems to me, the Aristotelian tradition is actually to unify those two intuitions that we have. That for Aristotle, by my reading, happiness is unimpeded activity. And we can only really fully, we can only be attained. So happiness is not a possession, but an activity, and that activity has to be in accord with our nature in order for it to be to be unimpeded, and it has to take an enduring form as an some form as an enduring disposition or virtue. But it strikes me as that even though theoretically I think St. Thomas also unifies these two poles, I think in our actual experience of life, they don't really come together, and we often feel ourselves toggling back and forth between those two sides. Well, it's been really a rich afternoon, only 2 hours, and so much brought forward by these wonderful presenters, and I'd like to conclude by thanking Jennifer Frey, Candace Vogler, and Father Thomas Joseph White for their excellent presentations and thoughtful responses to questions, even provocative ones from the moderator. So thank you very much for coming, and please remember the November 4th event here, same bat time, no, earlier bat time, but the same bat channel. So please join me in thanking the presenters.